or succumbing to the thinking patterns we are trying to avoid because we know they are signs of irrationality. A stop-and-think moment can be created. You can think about this as a way to implement accountability. We have discussed several patterns of irrationality in the way we lodge beliefs and field outcomes. From these, we can commit to vigilance around words, phrases, and thoughts that signal that we might not be our most rational selves. Your list of those warning signs will be specific to you or your family, friends, or enterprise. But here is a sample of the kinds of things that might trigger a decision interrupt. First, signs of the illusion of certainty. I know. I'm sure. I knew it. It always happens this way. I'm certain of it. You're 100% wrong. You have no idea what you're talking about. There's no way that's true. 0% or 100% or their equivalents, and other terms signaling that we're presuming things are more certain than we know they are. This also includes stating things as absolutes, like best or worst or always or never. Next, overconfidence, which is signaled by similar terms to the illusion of certainty. Next, irrational outcome fielding, like, I can't believe how unlucky I got, or the reverse if we have some default phrase for credit taking, like, I'm at the absolute top of my game, or I planned it perfectly. This includes conclusions of luck, skill, blame, or credit. It includes equivalent terms for irrationally fielding the outcomes of others, like, they totally had it coming, they brought it on themselves, and why do they always get so lucky? Next. Any kind of moaning or complaining about bad luck just to offload it, with no real point to the story other than to get sympathy. An exception would be when we're in a truth-seeking group and we make explicit that we're taking a momentary break to vent. Next, generalized characterizations of people meant to dismiss their ideas, like insulting, pejorative characterizations of others, like idiot or, in poker, donkey, or any phrase that starts by characterizing someone as another typical whatever. Like David Letterman said to Lauren Conrad, he dismissed everyone around him as an idiot until he pulled himself into deliberative mind one day and asked, what are the odds that everyone is an idiot? Next, other violations of the Mertonian norm of universalism, shooting the message because we don't think much of the messenger. Any sweeping term about somebody, particularly when we equate our assessment of an idea with a sweeping personality or intellectual assessment of the person delivering the idea, such as gun nut, bleeding heart, East Coast, Bible belter, California values, political or social issues. Also, be on guard for the reverse, accepting a message because of the messenger or praising a source immediately after finding out it confirms your thinking. Next, signals that we have zoomed in on a moment out of proportion with the scope of time, like worst day ever or the day from hell. Next, expressions that explicitly signal motivated reasoning, accepting or rejecting information without much evidence, like conventional wisdom or if you ask anybody or can you prove that it's not true? Similarly, look for expressions that you're participating in an echo chamber, like everyone agrees with me. Next, the word wrong, which deserves its own swear jar. The Mertonian norm of organized skepticism allows little place in exploratory discussion for the word wrong. Wrong is a conclusion, not a rationale. And it's not a particularly accurate conclusion since, as we know, nearly nothing is 100% or 0%. Any words or thoughts denying the existence of uncertainty should be a signal that we are heading toward a poorly calibrated decision. Next, lack of self-compassion. If we're going to be self-critical, the focus should be on the lesson and how to calibrate future decisions. Not, I have the worst judgment on relationships, or I should have known, or how could I be so stupid? Next, signals we're being overly generous editors when we share a story. Especially in our truth-seeking group, are we straying from sharing the facts to emphasize our version? Even outside our group, unless we're sharing a story purely for entertainment value, are we assuring that our listener will agree with us? In general, are we violating the Mertonian norm of communism? Next, infecting our listeners with a conflict of interest. including our own conclusion or belief when asking for advice or informing the listener of the outcome before getting their input. And last, terms that discourage engagement of others in their opinions, including expressions of certainty and also initial phrasing inconsistent with that great lesson from improvisation, yes and. That includes getting opinions or information from others and starting with no or but. This is by no means a complete list, but it provides a flavor of the kinds of statements and thinking that should trigger vigilance on our part. Once we recognize that we should watch out for particular words, phrases, and thoughts, when we find ourselves saying or thinking those things, we are breaking a contract, a commitment to truth-seeking. These terms are signals that we're succumbing to bias. Because if we're cutting the binding when we catch ourselves saying or thinking these things, it can trigger a moment of reflection, interrupting us in that moment. Popping out of the moment like that can remind us of why we took the trouble to list terms that signal potential decision traps. The swear jar is a simple example of a Ulysses contract in action. We think ahead to a hazard in our decision-making future and devise a plan of action around that, or at least commit that we will take a moment to recognize we are veering away from truth-seeking. Better pre-commitment contracts result from better anticipation of what the future might look like, what kinds of decisions we want to avoid, and which ones we want to promote. That takes thoughtful reconnaissance. Reconnaissance, mapping the future. Operation Overlord, the Allied forces operation to retake German-occupied France starting in Normandy, was the largest seaborne invasion in military history. It involved planning and logistics on an unprecedented scale. What if the forces were delayed at the start by bad weather? What if the airborne landing force had trouble communicating by radio due to the terrain? What if significant numbers of paratroopers were blown off course? What if currents interfered with the beach landings? What if the forces on the different beaches remained separated? Countless things could go wrong, with tens of thousands of lives at stake and, potentially, the outcome of the war. All those things did go wrong, along with many other challenges encountered on D-Day and immediately thereafter. The Normandy landing still succeeded, though, because they prepared for as many potential scenarios as possible. Reconnaissance has been part of advanced military planning for as long as horses have been used in battle. The modern military, of course, has evolved from sending scouts by horse and reporting back to the main forces, to planes, drones, satellites, and other high-tech equipment, gathering information about what to expect in battle. The Navy SEAL team that caught and killed Osama bin Laden wouldn't have entered his compound without knowing what they would find beyond the walls. What buildings were there? What was their layout and purpose? What differences might it make if they conducted the raid in different kinds of weather or different times of day? What other people would be present, and what risks would they pose? What would they do if bin Laden wasn't there? What was the team trying to commit to, given what they knew about each of those things, and of course, numerous others? Just as they relied on reconnaissance, we shouldn't plan our future without doing advance work on the range of futures that could result from any given decision and the probabilities of those futures occurring. For us to make better decisions, we need to perform reconnaissance on the future. If a decision is a bet on a particular future based on our beliefs, then before we place a bet, we should consider in detail what those possible futures might look like. If you look at the charts included in the PDF, we're reminded that any decision can result in a set of possible outcomes. Thinking about what futures are contained in that set, which we do by putting memories together in a novel way to imagine how things might turn out, helps us figure out which decisions to make. Figure out the possibilities, then take a stab at the probabilities. To start, we imagine the range of potential futures. This is also known as scenario planning. Nate Silver, who compiles and interprets data from the perspective of getting the best strategic use of it, frequently takes a scenario planning approach. Instead of using data to make a particular conclusion, he sometimes takes the approach of discussing all the scenarios the data could support. In early February 2017, he described the merits of scenario planning, Quote, when faced with highly uncertain conditions, military units and major corporations sometimes use an exercise called scenario planning. The idea is to consider a broad range of possibilities for how the future might unfold to help guide long-term planning and preparation. End quote. After identifying as many of the possible outcomes as we can, we want to make our best guess at the probability of each of those futures occurring. When I consult with enterprises on building decision trees and determining probabilities of different futures, people frequently resist having to make a guess at the probability of future events, mainly because they feel like they can't be certain of what the likelihood of any scenario is. But that's the point. The reason why we do reconnaissance is because we are uncertain. We don't and likely can't know how often things will turn out a certain way with exact precision. It's not about approaching our future predictions from a point of perfection. It's about acknowledging that we're already making a prediction about the future every time we make a decision. So we're better off if we make that explicit. If we're worried about guessing, we're already guessing. We are already guessing that the decision we execute will result in the highest likelihood of a good outcome, given the options we have available to us. By at least trying to assign probabilities, we will naturally move away from the default of 0% or 100%, away from being sure it will turn out one way and not another. Anything that moves us off those extremes is going to be a more reasonable assessment than not trying at all. Even if our assessment results in a wide range, like the chances of a particular scenario occurring being between 20% and 80%, that is still better than not guessing at all. This kind of reconnaissance of the future is something that experienced poker players are very familiar with. Before making a bet, poker players consider each of their opponent's possible responses, fold, call, raise, and the likelihood and desirability of each. They also think about what they will do in response if some or all of the opponents don't fold. Even if you don't know much about poker, it should make sense that a player is better off considering these things before they bet. The more expert the player, the further into the future they plan. Before making that decision to bet, the expert player is anticipating what they'll do following each response, as well as how the action they take now affects their future decisions on the hand. The best players think beyond the current hand into subsequent hands. How do the actions of this hand affect how they and their opponents make decisions on future hands? Poker players really live in this probabilistic world of what are the possible futures? What are the probabilities of those possible futures? And they get very comfortable with the fact that they don't know exactly because they can't see their opponent's cards. This is true of most strategic thinking, whether it involves sales strategies, business strategies, or courtroom strategies. The best strategists are considering a fuller range of possible scenarios, anticipating and considering the strategic responses to each, and so on deep into the decision tree. This kind of scenario planning is a form of mental time travel we can do on our own. It works even better when we do it as part of a scenario planning group, particularly one that is open-minded to dissent and diverse points of view. Diverse viewpoints allow for the identification of a wider variety of scenarios deeper into the tree, and for better estimates of their probability. In fact, if two people in the group are really far off on an estimate of the likelihood of an outcome, that is a great time to have them switch sides and argue the other's position. Generally, the answer is somewhere in the middle, and both people will end up moderating their positions. But sometimes one person has thought of a key influencing factor that the other hasn't, and that is revealed only because the dissent was tolerated. In addition to increasing decision quality, scouting various futures has numerous additional benefits. First, scenario planning reminds us that the future is inherently uncertain. By making that explicit in our decision-making process, we have a more realistic view of the world. Second, we are better prepared for how we are going to respond to different outcomes that might result from our initial decision. We can anticipate positive or negative developments and plan our strategy rather than being reactive. Being able to respond to the changing future is a good thing. Being surprised by the changing future is not. Scenario planning makes us nimbler because we've considered and are prepared for a wider variety of possible futures. And if our reconnaissance has identified situations where we are susceptible to irrationality, we can try to bind our hands with a Ulysses contract. Third, anticipating the range of outcomes also keeps us from unproductive regret or undeserved euphoria when a particular future happens. Finally, by mapping out the potential futures and probabilities, we are less likely to fall prey to resulting or hindsight bias, in which we gloss over the futures that did not occur and behave as if the one that did occur must have been inevitable, because we have memorialized all the possible futures that could have happened. In 2009, as part of my work on the board of directors, I consulted with a national nonprofit organization, After School All-Stars, to work with them on incorporating scenario planning into their budgeting. ASAS, founded in 1992 by Arnold Schwarzenegger, provides 3 hours of structured after-school programming for over 70,000 underserved youth in 18 cities across the United States. They depend heavily on grants for funding and were struggling with budget planning given the uncertainty in the grant award process. To help them with planning, I asked for a list of all their grant applications and how much each grant was worth. They provided me with a list of their outstanding grant applications and the award amounts applied for. I told them that I didn't see how much each grant was worth in the information they provided. They pointed to the column of the award amount sought. At that point, I realized we were working from different ideas about how to determine worth. The misunderstanding came from the disconnect between the expected value of each grant and the amount they would be awarded if they got the grant. I was asking them for each grant to calculate the expected value, which is the average long-run value calculated by multiplying the probability of each possible outcome by the likelihood each outcome will occur and taking the sum of those values. Coming up with the expected value of each grant involves a simple form of scenario planning, imagining the two possible futures that could result from the application, awarded or declined, and the likelihood of each future. For example, if they applied for a $100,000 grant that they would win 25% of the time, that grant would have an expected value of $25,000, or $100,000 multiplied by 0.25. If they expected to get the grant a quarter of the time, then it wasn't worth $100,000. It was worth a quarter of $100,000. A $200,000 application with a 10% chance of success would have an expected value of $20,000. A $50,000 grant with a 70% chance of success would be worth $35,000. Without thinking probabilistically in this way, determining a grant's worth isn't possible. It leads to the mistaken belief that the $200,000 grant is worth the most, when in fact, the $50,000 grant is. ASAS recognized that uncertainty was causing them problems, to the point where they felt enslaved by it in their budgeting. But they hadn't wrapped uncertainty into their planning or resource allocation process. They were flying by the seat of their pants. After I worked with the national office, ASAS made estimating the likelihood of getting each grant part of their planning. The benefits they got from scenario planning were immediate and substantial. They created a more efficient and productive work stack. Before doing this exercise, they naturally put a higher priority on applications seeking larger dollar amounts, executing those first, putting more senior staff on them, and being more likely to hire outside grant writers to get those applications completed. By shifting to thinking about the probability of getting each grant, they were now able to prioritize by how much the grant was actually worth to the organization in making these decisions. Thereafter, the higher value grants went to the top of the stack rather than just the grants with the higher potential awards. They could also budget more realistically. They had greater confidence in advance estimates of the amount of money they could expect to receive. Because coming up with an expected value required estimating the likelihood of getting the grant, they increasingly focused on improving the accuracy of their estimates. This prompted them to close the loop by going back to the grantors. They had previously, after rejections, followed up with their grantors. Because they were now focusing on checking and calibrating their probabilities, they expanded this to the grants they won. Overall, their post-outcome reviews focused on understanding what worked, what didn't work, what was luck, and how to do better, improving both their probability estimates and the quality of their grant applications. They could think about ways to increase the probability of getting grants and commit to those actions. They were less likely to fall prey to hindsight bias because they had considered in advance the probability of getting or not getting the grant. They were also less likely to fall prey to resulting because they had evaluated the decision process in advance of getting or not getting the grant. And finally, because of all the benefits ASAS received from incorporating scenario planning into budgeting and grant applications, they expanded the implementation of this type of scenario planning across departments, making it part of their decision-making culture. Grant prospecting is similar to sales prospecting, and this process can be implemented for any sales team. Assign probabilities for closing or not closing sales, and the company can do better at establishing sales priorities, planning budgets, and allocating resources, evaluating and fine-tuning the accuracy of its predictions, and protecting itself against resulting in hindsight bias. A more complex version of scenario planning occurs when the number of possible futures multiplies and/or we go deeper into the tree, considering what we will do next in response to how things turn out, and what the set of outcomes of that next decision is, and so on. Consider the scenario planning involved in Seahawks coach Pete Carroll's much-criticized Super Bowl decision, trailing by 4, 20 seconds remaining, one timeout, second and goal at the Patriots' one-yard line. Carroll has two general choices, run or pass, and they in turn lead to multiple scenarios. If Carroll calls for a run, these are the possible futures. A, touchdown, an immediate win. B, turnover or fumble, an immediate loss. C, tackle short of the goal line. D, offensive penalty. And E, defensive penalty. Futures C through E branch into additional scenarios. The most likely failure scenario by far is that the runner is tackled before reaching the end zone. Seattle could stop the clock with its final timeout, but if they run the ball again and do not score, time will expire. If Carroll calls for a pass, the possible futures are A, touchdown, immediate success, B, turnover or interception, immediate failure, C, incomplete pass, D, sack, E, offensive penalty, and F, defensive penalty. Again, the first two futures essentially end the game, and the others branch off into additional play calling and additional outcomes. The main difference between passing and running is that calling a pass likely gives Seattle a total of 3 plays to score instead of 2 if Carroll calls a running play. An unsuccessful run would require that Seattle use their final timeout to stop the clock so they could run a second play. An incomplete pass would stop the clock and leave Seattle with a timeout and the chance to call those same 2 running plays. An interception, which negates the possibility of a second or third offensive play, is only a 2-3% probability, a small price to pay for 3 chances to score rather than 2. A turnover caused by a fumble on a running play is about 1% to 2%. Notice that the option of the extra play does not reveal itself without this kind of scouting of the future. Even after the fact, with lots of time to analyze the decision, very few commentators saw this advantage. The important thing is that we do better when we scout all these futures and make decisions based on the probabilities and desirability of the different futures. ASAS couldn't guarantee it would get awarded every grant it applied for, but it could, through good process, make better decisions about which grants to prioritize and how much revenue to expect from the basket of grant proposals they submitted. Despite the outcry, I'd like to think that Pete Carroll didn't lose much sleep over his decision to call for Wilson to pass. Reconnaissance of the future dramatically improves decision quality and reduces reactivity to outcomes. So far, we have talked about thinking ahead to what the future might look like. But it turns out that better decision trees, more effective scenario planning, results from working backward rather than forward. Backcasting, working backward from a positive future. All methods of imagining the future are not created equal. You know that Chinese proverb, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step? Turns out, if we were contemplating a 1,000-mile walk, we'd be better off imagining ourselves looking back from the destination and figuring out how we got there. When it comes to advanced thinking, standing at the end and looking backward is much more effective than looking forward from the beginning. The distorted view we get when we look into the future from the present is similar to the stereotypical view of the world by Manhattan residents, poked fun at by the famous New Yorker cover. The cover was a drawing of a map from the perspective of a person from New York. In that view, half the map covers a few blocks of the city. While you can see all the buildings on 9th Avenue and even vehicles and people, the Hudson River and New Jersey are just horizontal strips. The entire United States occupies the same amount of space as the distances between 9th and 10th Avenues. Beyond a strip of the Pacific Ocean are three tiny lumps labeled China, Japan, and Russia. When we forecast the future, we run the risk of a similar distortion. From where we stand, the present and the immediate future loom large. Anything beyond that loses focus. Imagining the future recruits the same brain pathways as remembering the past. And it turns out that remembering the future is a better way to plan for it. From the vantage point of the present, it's hard to see past the next step. We end up overplanning for addressing problems we have right now. Implicit in that approach is the assumption that conditions will remain the same, facts won't change, and the paradigm will remain stable. The world changes too fast to assume that approach is generally valid. Samuel Arbismans' The Half-Life of Facts makes a book-length case for the hazards of assuming the future is going to be like the present. Just as great poker players and chess players and experts in any field excel by planning further into the future than others, our decision-making improves when we can more vividly imagine the future, free of the distortions of the present. By working backward from the goal, we plan our decision tree in more depth because we start at the end. When we identify the goal and work backward from there to quote-unquote remember how we got there, the research shows that we do better. In a Harvard Business Review article, decision scientist Gary Klein summarized the results of a 1989 experiment by Deborah Mitchell, J. Edward Russo, and Nancy Pennington. They, quote, found that prospective hindsight, imagining that an event has already occurred, increases the ability to correctly identify reasons for future outcomes by 30%, end quote. A huge urban planning project requires enormous amounts of money, materials, commitment, and the vision to work backward from a distant future goal. When Frederick Law Olmsted designed Central Park, for example, he recognized that a lot of the charm of the park and a lot of enjoyment that people would get from it would take decades as the landscape changed and matured. People walking through Central Park when it opened to the public in 1858 would have seen a lot of barren land. Even in 1873, when construction was substantially completed, there was a lot of undergrown foliage. The trees, shrubs, and plants were clearly recent transplants. None of those visitors would recognize Central Park today, but Olmsted would because he was starting from what it would develop into. The most common form of working backward from our goal to map out the future is known as backcasting. In backcasting, we imagine we've already achieved a positive outcome, holding up a newspaper with the headline, "We achieved our goal." Then we think about how we got there. Let's say an enterprise wants to develop a 3-year strategic plan to double market share from 5% to 10%. Each person engaged in the planning imagines holding up a newspaper whose headline reads, "Company X has doubled its market share over the past 3 years." The team leader now asks them to identify the reasons they got there, what events occurred, what decisions were made, what went their way to get the enterprise to capture that market share. This enables the company to better identify strategies, tactics, and actions that need to be implemented to get to the goal. It also allows it to identify when the goal needs to be tweaked. Backcasting makes it possible to identify when there are low probability events that must occur to reach the goal. This could lead to developing strategies to increase the chances those events occur or to recognizing the goal is too ambitious. The company can also make pre-commitments to a plan developed through backcasting, including responses to developments that can interfere with reaching the goal, and identifying inflection points for reevaluating the plan as the future unfolds. In planning a trial strategy after taking a new case, a trial lawyer can imagine the headline of winning a trial. What favorable rulings did the lawyer get along the way? How did the most favorable testimony play out? What kind of evidence did the judge allow or throw out? What points did the jury respond to? If our goal is to lose 20 pounds in 6 months, we can plan how to achieve that by imagining it 6 months from now and we've lost the weight. What are the things we did to lose the weight? How did we avoid junk food? How did we increase the amount of exercise we were doing? How did we stick to the regimen? Imagining a successful future and backcasting from there is a useful time-traveling exercise for identifying necessary steps for reaching our goals. Working backward helps even more when we give ourselves the freedom to imagine an unfavorable future. Premortems, working backward from a negative future. If you know medical terms or watch forensic crime dramas on TV, you're familiar with a postmortem. That's where a medical examiner determines the cause of death. A premortem is an investigation into something awful, but before it happens. We all like to bask in an optimistic view of the future. We generally are biased to overestimate the probability of good things happening. Looking at the world through those rose-colored glasses is natural and feels good, but a little naysaying goes a long way. A premortem is where we check our positive attitude at the door and imagine not achieving our goals. Backcasting and premortems complement each other. Backcasting imagines a positive future. A premortem imagines a negative future. We can't create a complete picture without representing both the positive space and the negative space. Backcasting reveals the positive space. Premortems reveal the negative space. Backcasting is the cheerleader. A premortem is the heckler in the audience. Imagining a headline that reads, "We failed to reach our goal," challenges us to think about ways in which things could go wrong that we otherwise wouldn't if left to our own optimistic team player devices. For the company with the 3-year plan to double market share, the premortem headline is, "Company fails to reach market share goal. Growth again stalls." Members of the planning team now imagine delays in new products, loss of key executives or sales or marketing or technical personnel, new products by competitors, adverse economic developments, paradigm shifts that could lead customers to do without the product or rely on alternatives not on the market or in use, etc. A lawyer trying a case now considers favorable evidence being disallowed, undiscovered evidence undermining the case, drawing an unsympathetic judge, and the jury disliking or distrusting the main witnesses. When we set a weight loss goal and put a plan to reach that goal in place, a premortem will reveal how we felt obligated to eat cake when it was somebody's birthday, how hard it was to resist the bagels and cookies in the conference room, and how hard it was to find time for the gym or how easy it was to find excuses to procrastinate going. There has been a massive amount written about visualizing success as a way to achieve our goals. Because that's such a common element in self-help strategies, conducting a premortem with its negative visualization may seem like a counterproductive way to succeed. Despite the popular wisdom that we achieve success through positive visualization, it turns out that incorporating negative visualization makes us more likely to achieve our goals. Gabrielle Odingen, professor of psychology at NYU, an author of Rethinking Positive Thinking, Inside the New Science of Motivation, has conducted over 20 years of research, consistently finding that people who imagine obstacles in the way of reaching their goals are more likely to achieve success, a process she has called mental contrasting. Her first study of women enrolled in a weight loss program found that subjects, quote, who had strong positive fantasies about slimming down lost 24 pounds less than those who pictured themselves more negatively. Dreaming about achieving a goal apparently didn't help that goal come to fruition. It impeded it from happening. The starry-eyed dreamers in the study were less energized to behave in ways that helped them lose weight, end quote. She repeated these results in different contexts. She recruited college students who claimed to have an unrequited crush. She then prompted one group to imagine positive scenarios of initiating a relationship, and another group to imagine negative scenarios of how that would play out. The results were similar to those in the weight loss study. 5 months later, the subjects indulging in the positive scenario planning were less likely to initiate the relationship. She found the same results when studying job seekers, students before a midterm exam, and patients undergoing hip replacement surgery. Odingen recognized that we need to have positive goals, but we are more likely to execute on those goals if we think about the negative futures. We start a premortem by imagining why we failed to reach our goal. Our company hasn't increased its market share. We didn't lose weight. The jury verdict came back for the other side. We didn't hit our sales target. Then we imagine why. All those reasons why we didn't achieve our goal help us anticipate potential obstacles and improve our likelihood of succeeding. A premortem is an implementation of the Mertonian norm of organized skepticism, changing the rules of the game to give permission for dissent. Being a team player in a premortem isn't about being the most enthusiastic cheerleader. It's about being the most productive heckler. Winning isn't about the group feeling good because everyone confirms their and the organization's narrative that things are going to turn out great. The premortem starts with working backward from an unfavorable future or failure to achieve a goal. So competing for favor or feeling good about contributing to the process is about coming up with the most creative, relevant, and actionable reasons for why things didn't work out. The key to a successful premortem is that everyone feels free to look for those reasons, and they are motivated to scour everything: personal experience, company experience, historical precedent, episodes of The Hills, sports analogies, etc., to come up with ways a decision or plan can go bad, so the team can anticipate and account for them. Conducting a premortem creates a path to act as our own red team. Once we frame the exercise as, okay, we failed, why did we fail? That frees everyone to identify potential points of failure they otherwise might not see or might not bring up for fear of being viewed as a naysayer. People can express their reservations without it sounding like they're saying the planned course of action is wrong. Because of that, a planning process that includes a premortem creates a much healthier organization because it means that the people who do have dissenting opinions are represented in the planning. They don't feel like they're shut out or not being heard. Everyone's voice now has more value. The organization is less likely to discourage dissent and thereby lose the value of diverse opinions. Those who have reservations are less likely to have resentment or regret build if things don't work out. Their voices were represented in the strategic plan. Incorporating this type of imagining of the negative space into a truth-seeking group reinforces a new habit routine of visualizing and anticipating future obstacles. As always, when a group we are part of reinforces this kind of thinking, we are more likely in our own thinking to consider the downside of our decisions. Imagining both positive and negative futures helps us build a more realistic vision of the future, allowing us to plan and prepare for a wider variety of challenges than backcasting alone. Once we recognize the things that can go wrong, we can protect against the bad outcomes, prepare plans of action, enable nimble responses to a wider range of future developments, and assimilate a negative reaction in advance so we aren't so surprised by it or reactive to it. In doing so, we are more likely to achieve our goals. Of course, when we backcast and imagine the things that went right, we reveal the problems of those things that didn't go right. Backcasting doesn't therefore ignore the negative space so much as it overrepresents the positive space. It's in our optimistic nature and natural in backcasting to imagine a successful future. Without a premortem, we don't see as many paths to the future in which we don't reach our goals. A premortem forces us to build out that side of the tree where things didn't work out. In the process, we are likely to realize that's a pretty robust part of the tree. Remember, the likelihood of positive and negative futures must add up to 100%. The positive space of backcasting and the negative space of a premortem still have to fit in a finite amount of space. When we see how much negative space there really is, we shrink down the positive space to a size that more accurately reflects reality and less reflects our naturally optimistic nature. We make better decisions, and we feel better about those decisions once we get our past, present, and future selves to hang out together. This not only allows us to adjust how optimistic we are, it allows us to adjust our goals accordingly and to actively put plans in place to reduce the likelihood of bad outcomes and increase the likelihood of good ones. We are less likely to be surprised by a bad outcome and can better prepare contingency plans. It may not feel so good during the planning process to include this focus on the negative space. Over the long run, however, seeing the world more objectively and making better decisions will feel better than turning a blind eye to negative scenarios. In a way, backcasting without premortems is a form of temporal discounting. If we imagine a positive future, we feel better now, but we'll more than compensate for giving up that immediate gratification through the benefits of seeing the world more accurately, making better initial decisions, and being nimbler about what the world throws our way. Once we make a decision and one of those possible futures actually happens, we can't discard all that work, even or especially if it included work on futures that did not occur. Forgetting about an unrealized future can be dangerous to good decision making. Dendrology and hindsight bias, or give the chainsaw a rest. One of the goals of mental time travel is keeping events in perspective. To understand an overriding risk to that perspective, think about time as a tree. The tree has a trunk, branches at the top, and the place where the trunk meets the branches. The trunk is the past. A tree has only one growing trunk, just as we have only one accumulating past. The branches are the potential futures. Thicker branches are the equivalent of more probable futures. Thinner branches are less probable ones. The place where the top of the trunk meets the branches is the present. There are many futures, many branches of the tree, but only one past, one trunk. As the future becomes the past, what happens to all those branches? The ever-advancing present acts like a chainsaw. When one of those many branches happens to be the way things turn out, when that branch transitions into the past, present us cuts off all those other branches that didn't materialize and obliterates them. When we look into the past and see only the thing that happened, it seems to have been inevitable. Why wouldn't it seem inevitable from that vantage point? Even the smallest of twigs, the most improbable of futures, like the 2-3% chance Russell Wilson would throw that interception, expands when it becomes part of the mighty trunk. That 2-3% in hindsight becomes 100%, and all the other branches, no matter how thick they were, disappear from view. That's hindsight bias, an enemy of probabilistic thinking. Judge Frank Easterbrook, a leading jurist and member of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, warned about the danger in the legal system of assessing probabilities after one of the potential futures has occurred. Gents versus ConAgra Foods involved a hot grain bin owned by ConAgra and the company it hired named Westside to investigate and deal with the cause of the burning smell, smoke, and raised temperatures from the bin. After failing to solve the problem, Westside's foreman told ConAgra to call the fire department. He then told some of his employees to remove tools from a tunnel to the bin that could impair firefighters' access. While the workers were in the tunnel, the bin exploded, severely injuring the Westside employees. Those injured sued ConAgra and Westside. The jury awarded $180 million in compensatory and punitive damages. In addressing the punitive damages against Westside, Judge Easterbrook, writing for the court, pointed out that Illinois law required a gross deviation from the standard of care to award punitive damages. Finding no evidence in the record of any foreseeable likelihood of explosion at the time the foreman ordered the workers to remove tools from the tunnel, he concluded, "The verdict appears to be a consequence of hindsight bias, the human tendency to believe that whatever happened was bound to happen and that everyone must have known it. If the foreman believed that an explosion was imminent, then he is a monster, but of that there is no evidence. Hindsight bias is not enough to support a verdict." Once we know there was an explosion, it's difficult to imagine the actions of the parties when the explosion was only one of several possible futures. The members of the jury had a conflict of interest. When they heard the story of the men entering the tunnel to retrieve the tools, they knew the outcome. The jury lopped off the other branches of the tree. All the other ways things could have turned out given the situation in the grain storage bin. And, in hindsight, all they could see was a confluence of circumstances with an inevitable tragedy at the end. Imagine how things would be different for the protagonist throughout this book if more of us acted like Judge Easterbrook. Steve Bartman could have used a stadium full of Cubs fans with Judge Easterbrook's perspective. They would have recognized that the Cubs losing the game was only one of many ways it could have turned out. At the moment Bartman and others around him reached for the foul ball, the branch of the future where Steve Bartman touches the ball was a small one, and the chance of the Cubs losing after that was the tiniest of twigs, requiring a number of unlikely on-field developments, like the pitching ace giving up hit after hit, and the great fielding shortstop committing a rare error on an inning-ending double play. Just as the foreman ordering workers into the tunnel didn't cause the explosion, Bartman touching the ball didn't cause the loss. He just got an unlucky result based on all the things that happened over which he had no control after the foul ball touched his hands. Pete Carroll in the world of Monday morning quarterbacks could have used the judge's reminder that we tend to assume that once something happens, it was bound to happen. If we don't try to hold all the potential futures in mind before one of them happens, it becomes almost impossible to realistically evaluate decisions or probabilities after. This turned out to be a big part of the problem for the CEO in the wake of firing his president. Although he had initially characterized the decision as one of his worst, when we reconstructed the tree, essentially picking the branches up off the ground and reattaching them, it was clear that he and his company had made a series of careful, deliberative decisions. Because they led to a negative result, however, the CEO had been consumed with regret. When he looked back at his decisions, he couldn't see all those branches and their likelihoods. He could only see the trunk. All he saw was a bad result. The CEO removed all those other branches with a chainsaw and ran them through a wood chipper. They disappeared, and he acted as if they never existed. That's what hindsight bias is, and we're all running amok through the forest with a chainsaw once we get an outcome. Once something occurs, we no longer think of it as probabilistic, or as ever having been probabilistic. This is how we get into the frame of mind where we say, I should have known, or I told you so. This is where unproductive regret comes from. By keeping an accurate representation of what could have happened, and not a version edited by hindsight, memorializing the scenario plans and decision trees we create through good planning process, we can be better calibrators going forward. We can also be happier by recognizing and getting comfortable with the uncertainty of the world. Instead of living in extremes, we can find contentment with doing our best under uncertain circumstances and being committed to improving from our experience. Reaction to the 2016 election provides another strong demonstration of what happens when we lop branches off the tree. Hillary Clinton had been favored going into the election, and her probability of winning, based on an accumulation of the polls, was somewhere between 60% and 70%, according to 538.com. When Donald Trump won, pollsters got the Pete Carroll treatment, maybe no one more than Nate Silver, founder of 538.com, and a thoughtful analyzer of polling data. Nate Silver was wrong. The pollsters missed it. Just like Brexit, the bookies blew it, etc. The press spun this as a certain win for Clinton, despite the Trump branch of the tree being no mere twig at 30% to 40%. By the day after the election, the Clinton branch had been severed. Only the Trump branch remained, and how could the pollsters and the polling process have been so blind? One of the things poker teaches is that we have to take satisfaction in assessing the probabilities of different outcomes given the decisions under consideration, and in executing the bet we think is best. With the constant stream of decisions and outcomes under uncertain conditions, you get used to losing a lot. To some degree, we're all outcome junkies. But the more we wean ourselves from that addiction, the happier we'll be. None of us is guaranteed a favorable outcome, and we're all going to experience plenty of unfavorable ones. We can always, however, make a good bet. And even when we make a bad bet, we usually get a second chance because we can learn from the experience and make a better bet the next time. Life, like poker, is one long game, and there are going to be a lot of losses, even after making the best possible bets. We are going to do better and be happier if we start by recognizing that we'll never be sure of the future. That changes our task from trying to be right every time, an impossible job, to navigating our way through the uncertainty by calibrating our beliefs to move toward, little by little, a more accurate and objective representation of the world. With strategic foresight and perspective, that's manageable work. If we keep learning and calibrating, we might even get good at it. This is Annie Duke. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Thinking and Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. This program was directed by Alan Tobin, executive producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2018 by Annie Duke. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.